from Nevada to South Carolina, Mississippi to Ohio, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, with the volatility in the equity markets and the recent inflationary cycle, investors may be looking for calmer waters. Alexander Spillane of Fisher Liberty Gold is here to talk about investing in precious metals. President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill is now in the U.S. Senate, where senators are already planning major changes. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Elon Musk has expressed concerns over the increase in deficit spending that could result from the reconciliation bill making its way through Congress. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And wrangling over the size of the state and local tax deduction in the reconciliation bill continues. It pits lawmakers from high-tax states against those from low-tax states. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Inflation has cooled, but the over 20% run-up in costs over the past 4 years has strained household budgets, and the equity markets have been a roller coaster. Alexander Spillane is founder and CEO of Fisher Liberty Gold. He's here to talk about the precious metals market. Alexander, welcome to American Radio Journal. Alexander, we have seen over the last couple of months very wild swings in the equity markets, up by hundreds of points one day, and the next week down by hundreds, if not thousands of points cumulative throughout a week. Is there a way that folks can get around all this roller coaster ride and bring some sort of stability to their investment efforts?
Of course. And that's exactly what I would recommend any client of ours do, is really just focus on shifting from growth back into value. No one puts their money into the stock market with the intention of protecting it. It's really only one objective, which is to grow your funds. Market cycles begin and they end at some point. So when we look at historic data, it shows that we've gone into a recession every 8 to 12 years. So we've been in this very, very long bull run, and the market's just been going up and up. But you have it coupled next to a lot of debt, global and federal debt and consumer debt are at all-time highs. So what makes more sense to me is really for people who don't have the risk tolerance and can't afford to lose money, this would not be the time for anybody to really go all in on one particular asset. So I think diversification is key here.
Diversification always is a very good investment strategy. Now, you specialize in precious metals, gold and silver. Tell us a little bit about how those markets work.
Gold is influenced by a variety of different factors. It's often regarded as a safe haven asset, and it's considered one of the best hedges in an inflation economy. So historically, what's driven the price of gold has been the value of the dollar, supply of money, the rate of inflation, global and federal debt amongst recession fears, and even the cost of oil. With that being said, right now is kind of this perfect storm for gold to do well. It's also one of the only forms of money that's not attached to a central bank, nor is it coupled with a nation's debt, which is one of the reasons why you're seeing banks stock up on gold in a way that we've never seen before. And if you've heard about the BRICS nations, they've been actively trying to throw the U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency. And one of the ideas that they had is that they would back this currency with gold. I think that when you ask me, how does it work? It's very simple. It's an asset that is proven to be stable over time recently with how well it's done. And I think that's a result of the different factors I just mentioned. With how well it's done over the past 25 years, it's averaged over 12% annually. And that's very comparable to what you'd see in the stock market. The difference is that if you own gold outright, you don't have any sort of third party or counterparty risk, and it's not reliant on any particular third party for performance, right?
So if someone were investing in gold here, Alexander, would you do that as a general investment policy? Is it an asset that can be used, say, for example, if you wanted to convert an IRA into gold, can you do that?
Absolutely. When clients come to us and they have a variety of different accounts, they may have cash in the bank, they may have a brokerage, But if they do have an IRA, I think that's the best account to do it with. And here's why. Because the reason people flock into gold in the first place is typically because they want to reduce their exposure to where they are. It's not common that you see somebody that has no investments whatsoever decide, I want to invest in gold one day. That's not typically an entry-level investment. What we typically see is people who have existing investments, they're the ones who want to diversify their portfolios. So when you do that with an IRA, you can actually do it tax-free, penalty-free, and fee-free. The reason I like that strategy is because you kill two birds with one stone. If you're somebody who's been in a 401k who rolled over to an IRA or you have either of those type of accounts, right now, a lot of people are very close to the highest balance they've ever achieved in those accounts because of how well the market has done. So simply what they're doing is they're taking their profits out of those positions in the retail brokerages, and they're rolling it to a self-directed account that doesn't limit them or restrict them to just stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. And a self-directed IRA is really the vehicle you need to then own gold on a tax-deferred basis inside your IRA. So when they do that, not only do they reduce their exposure to the market and take their money out at a high point, but then they're diversifying into an asset that's proven to perform extremely well during the worst case scenario that, let's say, the stock market does crash. Now, when we saw the recession of 08, when it first crashed from 2007, during that same time period from 07 to 2011, gold actually did 255%. Silver did even better, did 390%. So the clients who we saw diversify into those positions back then didn't just do better, they did much better in many cases.
In terms of buying gold, silver, other precious metals, do you actually take physical possession of the gold of the investment, or is it something that's held for you?
You have both choices. If you're buying with cash, we can send the physical gold and silver straight to your doorstep or to an address of your choice. But you can also hold it in a depository, which I like because it makes trading a little bit easier. If you want to get in and out of your precious metals rather than shipping them back to us and boxing them up yourself, if you hold them in a vault, the clients can sign one form, transfers the metals back to our vault, and then we get them a payment same day via check or wire. But if you're holding precious metals inside of an IRA, just like the cash in an IRA, you can't hold that physical cash in hand unless you're willing to take a distribution, and that's a taxable event. So the IRS just wants to make sure that they can track the value of your holdings, and they do require that you hold it in a depository. But the good news is that if you do hold precious metals in an IRA, you can take possession of those metals at any point. They are physical and you own them outright. When you take possession of them from the IRA, of course, it is a taxable event, but oftentimes that can even reduce the client's taxable reportability because of the lower reporting requirement that physical gold and silver has on the back end of that process. So I think it's a great strategy for anybody who's even close to the age of taking distributions. You know, once clients are 73 years old and they're holding any sort of funds in an IRA, they have to take a mandatory distribution every year for the rest of their life. And that's the IRS's way of starting to collect income tax on those funds that have been deferred all that time. So when you do that with gold and silver, the benefit is that unlike the stock market, like let's say you have a mandatory distribution and you're back in 2007 after the market just lost 57%, now you're selling at a loss and it makes it very hard to recover. So when you hold gold and silver in your IRA and you take that distribution in kind, the benefit is if there was any volatility in gold and silver, you don't even have to sell it. You can literally just start creating a stockpile outside the IRA with those same assets.
All very interesting, and I'm sure folks will have a lot of questions. So, Alexander, can you tell us a little bit about your organization, Fisher Liberty Gold, where you are the founder and CEO? Tell us a bit about Fisher Liberty Gold. Also, how can folks get a hold of you if they'd like to follow up and learn a little bit more?
For anyone listening, I would recommend that you text keyword metals to 26786. And again, that's metals to 26786. And that'll get you a free information kit. You'll receive a text back and then you just fill out your information, your email, and we'll send that right to you. FisherLibertyGold.com is another way that you can reach us. There's a lot of different products that are offered on the market, and our job is to make sure that our clients are educated on all their options.
We have been talking again with Alexander Spillane, who is the founder and CEO of Fisher Liberty Gold. Alexander, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We have been, for the last few weeks, watching as the reconciliation bill, also known as One Big Beautiful Bill, has been working its way through the congressional legislative process. And keeping an eye on all the sausage making is Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you, Loman.
And now, Scott, as we reported last week, the reconciliation bill has moved from the U.S. House of Representatives into the Senate. A whole new set of dynamics there. Can you give us an update on what the Senate has been doing to try to move this process forward?
I think the look ahead for the next couple of weeks is, you know, there's going to be drama filled in the United States Senate political theater. You'll have President Trump engaging directly with senators. And, you know, I ultimately do believe, sort of like giving away the punchline, but I think we're going to get a big, beautiful bill done through the Senate, and then it'll be kicked back to the House where they'll have final passage and send the bill to the president's desk. But the main thing that the listeners need to understand today is that what the House passed was a starting point, and a very, very good starting point to extend and expand the 2017 Trump tax cuts. But the issue here is that reconciliation and the process, the structure, and the framework that sort of governs how that bill is resolved is going to undergo the Byrd rule and the Byrd bath and really the adjudication of various spending and revenue changes, along with this big debt limit increase. All that's going to be packed into the bill. So you're going to see senators raise their hand and talk about what priorities they want to see added to the bill, or they're going to object to various provisions that they don't think should be included. One of the big negotiating points that the House conducted in the final days of that negotiation was over the state and local tax deduction. And what this does is it allows high tax states to have an enormous deduction for people that face big government taxes like New York or New Jersey or California, especially as it pertains to property taxes. And, you know, obviously there's other localities and counties throughout America that also have very, very high property taxes. But in general, the SALT deduction is where low tax states are using their federal taxpayers to subsidize this big tax deduction. And there were obviously about five members of the House of Representatives that held on negotiations, and they ended up taking that deduction from $10,000 in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act from 2017 and expanding that all the way to $40,000 and setting these new income thresholds at about $500,000 and then allowing it to grow by 1% each year. That's a big, big expensive provision of the tax extension and expansion. And the thing about Republicans in the United States Senate is not a single one of them is from a blue state like New York, California, or New Jersey, these states that are relying upon the deduction for political reasons, like those moderate Republicans that claim they own the majority of the House of Representatives. And so I think that it's going to be a question that a lot of senators say, hey, you know, should we scale this back? You know, we need to have a reality here of what can also pass the Senate. And there's a lot of conservatives that don't like the idea of their low tax state subsidizing California and New York. The next big issue is going to be how people look at deficit reduction and the various provisions, because this is not just related to tax policy. But there's a few hundred billion dollars for defense spending. There's money for enhancing border security. There's, you know, obviously the debt limit increase. That's a provision that Rand Paul came out this week and said, as long as the debt limit increase is in there, he's going to be voting against the bill. He's sort of laying his marker out there. And I think his opposition is notable because he's somebody that doesn't frequently, change his positions once he's established them. Other members like Ron Johnson have from Wisconsin have really tried to lay out a path forward on fiscal responsibility that protects American opportunity for the next generation. And he's talking a lot about being concerned for what the debt and deficit looks like for his own kids and his grandkids. And so I think that's worth watching. Biden had the Inflation Reduction Act that had these out of control green and clean energy tax credits. And the House bill did pare them back significantly, but it didn't fully and immediately repeal that big legacy item from President Biden. I think that there are some parochial concerns from a handful of senators like Lisa Murkowski, John Curtis, Jerry Moran, and those guys are pretty concerned about the credits going away, and they want to preserve them. Obviously, Club for Growth would like to see those credits completely go away. They are distortions of the tax code. They're distortions of free markets, and we think that the Inflation Reduction Act did nothing in terms of reducing inflation.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C., and our members are united in the idea of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. You can visit us at clubforgrowth.org and learn more about the tax extension and learn more about the other policies that the club supports.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you very much. Elon Musk says some parts of the One Big Beautiful Bill are not so beautiful. With analysis of his remarks, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Elon Musk says that he's disappointed to see the House pass a major tax bill that will require the federal government to borrow trillions of dollars in the coming years. That bill, which is now in front of the Senate and faces an uncertain future, could undermine the work that the Department of Government Efficiency has been doing. At least that's what Musk told CBS News earlier this week. And I think he's right. The big, beautiful bill that the House passed last week is a bad deal for Americans, not because it cuts taxes. Tax cuts are great. But because it will end up raising the deficit in future years, require the federal government to borrow even more heavily and more speedily than it is already borrowing. And I think it's important that Musk is speaking out on this. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. As I said, Musk has called the bill disappointing, or rather the bill's passage disappointing, and said that it's undermining some of the work that he's been trying to do to streamline government and reduce government spending. Here's how he put it in that interview with CBS News this week.
Disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decrease it, and undermines the work that the DOGE team is doing.
I actually thought that when this big, beautiful bill came along. I mean, like, everything he's done on DOGE gets wiped out in the first year.
I think a bill can be big, or it can be beautiful. But I don't know if it can be both.
I think Musk is right on here. While DOGE has been unable to deliver on some of the grand promises that Musk made during last year's campaign and during the presidential transition process, President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act is moving the federal budget in the opposite direction, in the wrong direction. The Congressional Budget Office says that the bill will add $2.3 trillion to the deficit over 10 years, and that's probably a pretty optimistic projection because it includes a bunch of gimmicks in the bill that are meant to reduce the apparent impact on the deficit. Other estimates by independent entities like the Yale Budget Lab and the Penn Wharton Budget Model at the University of Pennsylvania say that the bill will add $3 trillion to the deficit as written, and potentially as much as $5 trillion once you strip out all those gimmicks that are in there. Now, the tax bill does, in fairness, include some pretty sizable spending cuts, and it's not even really fair to call this a tax bill because it's a bunch of other things, too. A lot of those spending cuts are aimed at Medicaid, which is the program that provides health insurance to the poor. The bill would establish new work requirements for Medicaid recipients who are childless adults without disabilities. It would also close a loophole that states have used for years to collect larger sums of federal Medicaid payments by taxing nursing homes and then refunding that money with federal dollars. Those are all worthwhile maneuvers. And despite the Democratic talking points about how these are Medicaid cuts, actually, overall Medicaid spending will continue to grow even under this proposal, even under the big, beautiful bill. So it's not really a cut at all. It's just changing the way the money gets spent. However, those cuts, those spending cuts, are really swamped by the budgetary consequences of extending and expanding the 2017 tax cuts. Of course, this bill doesn't just extend the tax cuts. It would also add to them, adding Trump's favored policies like exempting tips from taxes, exempting Social Security income, car loans, and overtime payments, all of that being exempted from federal income taxes. The bill would also create a number of new tax-sheltered savings accounts, and it would increase spending on a bunch of different things too, including the military and border enforcement. So as Musk put it in that interview, this is a bill that could either be big or it could be beautiful, but it probably can't be both. There's just too much in here, and the deficit issue is really the big one. Now, in a lot of ways, I think the debate over the big, beautiful bill is really the latest version of what's been kind of an ongoing intra-Republican or intra-conservative debate going back, honestly, a decade or more. And that debate centers on the question of whether fiscal responsibility is just a talking point that you use to win elections or whether it's a serious policy goal. The specifics change, but when push comes to shove, it seems like Republicans pretty consistently have chosen spending increases and tax cuts, even when those proposals will make the budget deficit worse and add to the national debt. Now, they've consistently done that. Not always. There were some serious moves during the Obama years, especially to try to contain future spending and actually reduce what the government spends. But those have been few and far between. And against that backdrop, Musk's criticism of this bill seems significant because even though he's stepping back in his role from the Trump administration, Musk is still very much a star in the broader conservative movement. And I think he's one of the few people who could probably get away with openly disagreeing with the president about something like this. He's respected enough to do that. And look, I've been critical of Musk before, including right here on this program. I've talked about how the Doge project has kind of missed a big opportunity, about how it's really failed to follow through on the spending cuts that Musk promised. I mean, he promised $2 trillion in spending cuts, and he's so far delivered far less than that. But Musk was absolutely right when he said that federal spending needs to be slashed, and when he said that the government wastes too much of taxpayers' dollars. And I think he's right again right now to say that the big, beautiful bill is going to make those problems worse. And by speaking up, he might give some political cover to people in the Senate who actually do have a vote on what happens with the bill. And there's already some senators who are sending the same message as Musk. For example, here's Senator Rand Paul on Fox News last Sunday.
I supported the tax cuts in 2017. I support making them permanent, so I support that part of the bill. I support spending cuts. I think the cuts currently in the bill are wimpy and anemic, but I still would support the bill, even with wimpy and anemic cuts, if they weren't going to explode the debt. The problem is the math doesn't add up. There's got to be someone left in Washington who thinks debt is wrong and deficits are wrong and wants to go in the other direction. The idea that we're going to explode deficits and the projections are now looking at over $3 trillion in deficits over the next 10 years, I think is just, you know, not a serious proposal.
For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of what's going on in Congress and around the country this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
It is known as SALT, the state and local tax deduction. It has become a major sticking point in efforts to renew the 2017 Trump tax cuts. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
For Americans rightly concerned about the looming expiration of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, or the Trump tax cuts, the recent effort in Washington to pass one big beautiful bill by the U.S. House of Representatives offers some incredible wins for taxpayers. At its core, the effort reduces tax rates on personal income and preserves key provisions for small businesses, measures that are key to economic growth and well-being, and measures that were otherwise set to vanish at the end of the year. After the TCJA was signed into law in 2017, real median household income rose substantially, unemployment dropped to historic lows, and business investment surged. Repealing those gains would be more than a policy mistake. It would be an economic blow to millions of working Americans. It would mean fewer jobs, lower wages, and higher prices, all while making the United States less competitive globally. But as always in Washington, no good idea is safe from political horse trading. enter the renewed push to dramatically expand the state and local tax deduction, or SALT, a perennial gift to high-income earners in high-tax states, dressed up as relief for the middle class. The SALT deduction has existed in one way or another since the federal income tax was first allowed under the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. An important historical note, let's not forget the founders prohibited the federal government from levying a direct income tax on Americans altogether in the Constitution. The SALT deduction, at least in theory, lets taxpayers deduct what they pay in state and local taxes from their federal tax liability. And at first glance, that might seem fair. But in practice, it has been anything but. After the passage of the TCJ in 2017, the SALT deduction was capped at $10,000 annually. However, the language recently passed by the U.S. House would make a step backwards on the SALT deduction by increasing the cap to a whopping $40,000. That deduction does phase out for those earning more than $500,000, falling back to that $10,000 cap for the highest earners. Both the cap and the income threshold grow at 1% annually until 2033, based on the House language. Carve-outs such as the increased SALT cap come directly at the expense of hard-earned tax relief for Americans and applies more broadly and neutrally, such as much more globally competitive 15% business tax rate. So while politicians in states like New York and California point to SALT as a middle-class benefit, the numbers tell a far different story. SALT is a mechanism for really socializing the costs of big government policies in a few states across the rest of the nation. The political incentives are clear enough. Elected officials from high-tax, generally blue states want to shield their constituents from the consequences of their state's policies without doing the hard work of reducing spending or reining in tax burdens at the state level. If residents of New York or California want expensive government services, of course, that's their right. But they should pay for it themselves, directly and transparently. They should not expect working families in Texas or Tennessee or Indiana to subsidize their choices through the federal tax code. As we pointed out in our ALEC Rich States, Poor States report every year, one of the most powerful features of the American system is competitive federalism. States are free to make their own policy choices, but they must also live with the results. That's what drives innovation and discipline. When a state fails, its people can either demand change or vote with their feet. But when Washington steps in to mask those failures of high-tax states, it removes the most basic form of accountability, and that is competition. We should all look to strengthen this competitive federalism framework across our country. The renewal of the Trump tax cuts will protect Americans from a devastating tax increase at the end of the year and will be a powerful influence for economic growth, just as the 2017 tax relief proved to be. Looking at common sense ideas like additional tax rate relief and scrutinizing the expanded SALT deduction will be points of debate as the tax reform discussion moves forward in Washington this summer. Most importantly, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that the U.S. House just passed makes permanent the personal income tax cuts from 2017. The threat of a massive tax increase that would have hit millions of taxpayers and threatened economic recession looks much less likely to occur after the hard work of House Speaker Mike Johnson and his colleagues in the U.S. House. For more information on this and other policy topics, you can visit ALEC.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KYRN-AM in Salem, Oregon. Welcome to our new listeners in the Beaver State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal. lighting the brush fires of freedom.